Hello, everyone, and welcome to New Books in French Studies, discussions with scholars of France and the Francophone world about their new books. I'm your host, Roxane Panchassi. My guest today is Camille Robsis, author of The Law of Kinship, Anthropology, Psychoanalysis, and the Family in France. The book was published by Cornell University Press in 2013. Hi there, Camille.
Hi, Roxane.
Thanks so much for taking the time to speak with me today.
No, thank you. I'm a fan of your show, your podcast.
Oh, I'm glad to hear that. So maybe you could get us started by telling us a little bit about yourself and your background and how you came to study French history.
Yeah, sure. So that's a sort of complicated question because I have a complicated background. But the short version is that my mother is Mexican and my father is French. My mom is a diplomat and worked for the Mexican Foreign Service. So we basically moved around the world. And I went to a French school. My brother and I both went to French schools throughout. And one of the things about these French schools abroad is that they're super, you know, with France's super centralized education system, you basically are studying the same thing wherever you go at any time. So you could change countries and basically be studying the same Rousseau and the same, you know. Mm-hmm. So I had I didn't live in France very much growing up, but I had a sort of a French educational background. And then I ended up, after the bac, I ended up going to university in the U.S. I went to Brown University, and I was not thinking at all of majoring in history, and certainly not in French history. But I was sort of interested in theoretical questions, and as these things happened, there was a fantastic professor of French history at Brown at the time, Carolyn Dean, and she was teaching a course in modern French history, and I went the first day and looked at the syllabus, and I was amazed that, you know, most of these books I hadn't heard of, the books she was teaching, or these were issues that I had barely touched in a French high school, mm-hmm. Like the Algerian War, like the collaboration of Vichy, the questions of race, sexuality, and basically issues that I hadn't thought of explicitly in a French high school. And so I took the class, and the issues that we were discussing in the class matched up with some of the other theoretical issues that I was investigating in other classes, especially around questions of universalism, of difference, of political theory. And so I decided to basically write a thesis in French history. And then when I applied to graduate school, it seemed like an obvious choice to continue thinking about some of these larger theoretical questions that I had.
And how about the genesis of this project in particular? Where did you get the idea for this book? And how did you decide to work on these questions and issues?
In some ways, this was a continuation again of some of the questions that I had explored, been exploring for many years, particularly around this problem of French universalism and difference, and how France had dealt with questions of race, of sexuality, of gender. This book in particular was kind of the culmination of many things. The first thing I should say is that it was, you know, basically like in the news when I started to work on this. The PACS debates were raging.
So this is the civil union.
Exactly. Sorry. Yeah. The civil union law that I write about in the book. So that was, you know, all over the news, and people were writing about this, and I was following this just like an informed citizen, basically. And I thought it was very interesting what was happening in France in terms of the language that was being used, which I'm assuming we'll talk about later, but the kind of arguments that were being used, the language that was being used. So I wanted to write about that. And then I was also, when I got to graduate school, I did my PhD at Cornell, which still has actually a very strong kind of psychoanalysis contingent. So I was taking a lot of courses on psychoanalysis. I worked with Dominic LaCapra, who wrote a lot on psychoanalysis, and I also took courses with other people with kind of hardcore Lacanians. And so I started to read a lot of psychoanalysis and to think about questions of sexuality from a psychoanalytic point of view, which was very different from the kind of social constructionist perspective that I had more in college. So thinking about the unconscious, thinking about desire, thinking about bodies, et cetera, from a more psychoanalytic perspective. So these were the, you know, trying to think about gender and sexuality from a psychoanalytic perspective, basically. So all of that culminated into this book.
It's really interesting to hear you talk about that, that background, well, personally, but also intellectually, because I can, now that I've read the book, I can really see how all of those threads come together in the different issues that you tackle in it. In the introduction to the book, Camille, you describe the project here as an attempt to explain, and your word is the entanglement of this thing called familialism mm-hmm. and structuralism, and, you know, to examine why these two things are so successful in French political culture. So I wonder if we could start there, and if you could give us a bit of a sketch of what familialism means, what structuralism is, and I know that that's kind of a ridiculous question for me to ask, but I'm going to ask it anyway. And what makes the study of the intersection of these two big isms, you know, unique or specific in the French context?
Yeah. So, that's a hard question because it took me the whole book to figure this out. But I think familialism, how I'm using it in the book is the idea that the family is absolutely central to the social. Not just that it's important to the social, because I think most countries, most political cultures, you know, give the family an important role in the constitution of the nation and in the kind of vision of political unity. But here, the French, what I'm calling here French familialism, was the idea that the family was absolutely, was constitutive of the social. Like you could have no social without the family. Mm-hmm. And again, given the sort of importance of the social in French history, which is again something we can talk about later, you know, the family ended up being very important, in particular the heterosexual family. And so the part of the beginning of the book traces how and why the family was so important in French political culture, in particularly through two vectors. The first through the law, and in particular through the kind of the role of the family in the civil code and in the 1804 Napoleonic Code, because the family was one of the two pillars basically of the civil code, along with property. And the second axis is the role of the family in public policy and social policy, and the family was basically absolutely essential for all social policy, basically from the end of the 19th century throughout the early 20th century, throughout Vichy, and up until the post-war reconstruction. So there's a kind of, one of the things I was most amazed when I researched this book was the kind of continuity of family policy in France from its beginning, it's basically at the end of the 19th century up to, the 1960s, basically. So that's for familialism. And structuralism, that's a hard one too. I mean, the way that I'm... Here, I should say, is that the structuralism I'm talking about in the book is structuralist anthropology and structuralist psychoanalysis. And I would say that they share two characteristics. The first one is that there's a way to think about systems as a totality and outside of any historical specificity, to try to propose a kind of universal, ahistorical system, totalizing system. For example, both Lévi-Strauss and Lacan, who are the main figures in this book, are interested in thinking about kinship not as products of a particular culture or a particular time or particular circumstances, but as universal ahistorical structures that have, you know, been with us, that are co-constitutive of humanity.
So in the first part of the book, Camille, you reach back historically, and you just mentioned this, to the Napoleonic Code of 1804 and then the French Family Code of 1939. And you're sort of looking at the roots of this familialism in the French context. And you talk about, and you've already raised this a little bit, the ways that familialism has been kind of intertwined with and, I guess, constitutive of republicanism and universalism, these very, very French notions, mm-hmm. Politically. So how does that work in the first part of the book? How does that history connect the history of familialism with the history of French republicanism and universalism?
So, In terms of the law part of this, the Napoleonic Code, I spent some time thinking about the genesis of the code and how it was constructed, and Suzanne Dessens' book was very helpful for that, because one of the things that the revolutionaries did is that there was a huge upheaval of family law, and so the Thermidorians, and especially Napoleon, were very interested in giving, you know, individuals kind of framing mechanisms so that the passions wouldn't be out of control and you wouldn't have another terror again. And one of the framing mechanisms that they put in place was the family, was trying to, you know, go back on some of these family reforms of the revolution and re-solidify, in particular, the system of legitimacy and marriage. So what was interesting to me about how this links to the social more generally is that there's very, you know, the people who were writing the code were, and Napoleon also, were very interested in thinking of the family not as a natural phenomenon, but as a social phenomenon that we needed to preserve, almost as a fiction, but that was necessary for kind of social and psychic stability. There's this idea that, you know, people, it doesn't matter what they do on the side, but that the law needs to look at, you know, basically legitimate marriage and legitimate filiation, and take that, only that, into consideration. So the family was kind of the way, you know, the term I use is that the family was kind of the key to the Republican social contract. Of course, the Napoleonic Code was not necessarily Republican, but you know, because it when it was originally written out, but because it, I use the expression of Jean Carbonnier, the legal scholar, who basically called the civil code the France's constitution, basically, because it remained in place basically till today, you know, with a few few modifications, but the structure of the civil code is still the one we use today. So that's in terms of the civil code. In terms of family policy, I also look at the 1939 family code, which was a document that was promoted by familialists, by family activists, basically, since the end of the 19th century. And these were very, you know, I look at who they were, basically, and they're different. Some were social Catholics, some were kind of paternalist, entrepreneurial business leaders. Some were priests explicitly. One of the things that was interesting to me is that despite the kind of range of political positions that all of these familialists argued, that the family was absolutely key to solving France's multiple social problems, in particular the famous social question that haunted French policymakers and French social theorists, basically since the end of the 19th century. So how do we think about, the cohesion of the social, the whole of the social, and not just have a world, a society that's made of separate individuals, but how do we try to think about the kind of beyond the individuals and what makes them congeal as a whole? So they promoted the family, and in particular, one of the things that's very interesting is that the end of the 19th century is also coincides with a kind of time of depopulation, the mm-hmm. fear. Population. And so a lot of the people who were pushing for a family policy in France were the people who were very worried about depopulation. And they said that the way to solve depopulation was to give family benefits that would make basically people have more children. But that was not just a numerical agenda. It was also a kind of theoretical agenda that the family would also solve all these other social questions in France. Like, so, you know, all of the problems of the end of the 19th century would be solved by a strong family policy. So in that way, again, it was seen as kind of the solution to the Republican social contract as the key to it.
So you say at some point during this discussion that your goal here is to really, and I'm quoting here, to account for the significance and the longevity of these legal frameworks. So what do you argue along those lines? What did you come up with in terms of why this 1804 code and this 1939 code, the persistence of these things in terms of legal frameworks in France?
Yeah, I mean, I mean, in some ways, it's because of this equation between the family and the social, you know, because it seemed like if you went against it, that you would go against the social, hence you would go against republicanism, hence you would go against basically France, you know. And I think if you understand that equation at the beginning, it makes sense. You know, the end of the book makes more sense, where I mentioned basically how, you know, homosexuality or single-sex parenting or non-traditional families were constructed as a threat to the nation, not just as a threat to threat to republicanism. So I think it's because they argued so much for this necessary link between family and heterosexual family and republicanism, that it was very hard to critique on any side. And again, one of the things that I think was really interesting and surprising when I was doing the research for this book is that basically all political parties defended the family until this day. But it wasn't the civil code was not modified until the 60s and 70s, which is what I address in the second part of the book. But essentially, it stayed in place throughout very, very different political regimes. So despite the difference in political regimes, everyone could agree that family policy and family benefits were crucial. And that that giving the family a foundational role in civil law was also very important.
Well, and I'm going to want to follow up with you on that in terms of the contemporary resonance of some of these issues. But before we do that, let's talk about these notions of kinship and the symbolic that are so significant to the arguments that you're making in the book. You devote a chapter to the discussion of these ideas in the works and the early texts of two really towering figures of French intellectual life in the 20th century, so Claude Lévi-Strauss and Jacques Lacan. So can you give us a bit of an outline of these concepts and the roles, these concepts of kinship and the symbolic and the roles that they've played in relationship to the French legal and political familialism that you're treating in the book?
Yeah, so what I was interested in Lévi-Strauss and Lacan was basically to think about So you know, these figures, they weren't reading French familialist activists, and the early French familial activists were not reading Claude Lévi-Strauss and Jacques Lacan because they came after. So it wasn't a sort of cause and effect relation that they had. But I was interested in the fact that they made that kind of these two structuralist thinkers and the familialist political activists were making analogous arguments about the role of kinship and the social. So the argument that I develop in the second chapter of the book, which is devoted to Lévi-Strauss and Lacan, is that basically, so for example, let's take the case of Lévi-Strauss to begin with. Lévi-Strauss writes The Elementary Structures of Kinship, which is the most important book he wrote on kinship, right after the war. And one of the things he says is that after World War II, I should say, and one of the things he says is that, until now, everybody who had tried to think of kinship, who could to give an account of kinship, had failed to give a kind of totalizing, universalizing, final, definitive account of how kinship had emerged. And more specifically, the question that is troubling Lévi-Strauss is, how do we know what is natural and what is socially acquired? How do you think the distinction between nature and culture? And so he goes through kind of all of the history of people who've worked on kinship, and he, you know, criticizes each one and finally says, you know, the only way that we can distinguish, and he says at the beginning of the book, I should say something like, you know, I am finally going to give you the definitive account of this, right? it's a massive, ambitious, extremely ambitious book. And, you know, finally he says, well, the only way we can think about the difference between nature and culture is through this, the incest taboo, the incest prohibition, the prohibition of incest. Every culture has a form of prohibition of incest. And it's not just something that's natural, because there's obviously incest has happened. So it's not like there's a natural instinct against mm-hmm. incest. And it's not just purely socially constructed either, because if it were just pure social construction, you wouldn't be able to account for the fact that this has happened in all times and all places. because, you know, cultures differ. So how do you explain the kind of universality of it?
Right.
And so this is where he, I think he gives a structural explanation, in some ways bypassing the cause and effect, you know, answer and saying, well, this is just something that happens. And without that, we can't understand how we get to society, how societies are formed. And so basically, you know, he makes the incest prohibition the key to the constitution of society. And how we get from that to kinship is that basically Levi-Strauss says, the prohibition of incest is not so much the fact that you can't marry your sister or your mother, but it means that because you can't marry the women in your tribe, you have to go marry other women outside of your tribe. Hence, the consequence of the incest prohibition is exogamy. It's marriage outside of the clan,
right,
and the exchange of women. So again, this is something that, you know, Gail Rubin has written about, that Judith Butler has written about, but basically how the incest prohibition in Levi-Strauss is basically the condition of the creation of a kind of compulsory heterosexuality, if you'd like.
So is this the structuralist social contract that you talk about in the book? Is that what you've outlined for us? Yeah.
It's hard to explain, but in the book I have a kind of an arrow. And when I teach these texts, I think the arrow is the way to think about it, because Levi-Strauss posits a state of nature. He says there's a state of nature, but it's never existed. But one could imagine, and the state of nature would be a kind of pure animality, right? A realm of pure animality. And then was there a state of culture or society that he uses the term interchangeably. And to get from one to the other, there's this kind of arrow, which is called the incest prohibition. But you can't go back. It's not like you could say at some point, like, I'm going to refuse the incest prohibition and I'm going to go back to a state of nature, right? Because that would be logically impossible. So he does this in a very kind of smart, careful argument in the book, you know, to try to show how we have to participate in the system of exchange, because we are, as humans, always already social. So that's for Levi-Strauss. And Lacan, what's interesting is that, you know, Levi-Strauss sort of ends with the end of The Elementary Structures is really fascinating, because he ends with Freud, and he goes back to Totem. He ends actually with linguistics, and he says, you know, out of all the... I should backtrack a little bit. It's also the other important thing about The Elementary Structures of Kinship is that Levi-Strauss is kind of trying to promote this as a new anthropology, right, as a new structuralist anthropology, and he's breaking with kind of previous anthropology, which was tainted by Vichy and was quite complicit with racism and colonialism. So it's a very, you know, it's a book that has a kind of also disciplinary ambition. And he ends with Freud, and he says, look, the place to look now is actually linguistics, because linguistics is the only discipline that's been able to think structurally about certain things. And he turns to Freud and he says, Freud, you know, Totem and Taboo had a good idea. He realized that, you know, that basically exogamy is the root of society. But Freud is so preoccupied by history, and so he goes into this crazy narrative about the brothers killing the father, and basically no one, he doesn't even believe it. Nobody believes the story. But he's caught in this historical model. And so, in fact, what we have to do is forget this historical model and go to structures that have been in people's minds throughout all times. And in some ways, like, kicks history out of the door. And ends with that, you know, and this is basically the very last pages of Elementary Structures. And so my reading of Lacan is that Lacan sort of picks up where Levi-Strauss ends on this question of a structural understanding of kinship in the subject, not just in the social, but also in the individual subject. And he links that to the Oedipus complex and says, you know, again, all of these people have, all of the psychoanalysts have been obsessed with, have misunderstood the kind of force of Freud, which was basically to offer a structural understanding of subjectivity and of the social and of kinship. But Freud didn't have the kind of, I guess, a theoretical, daringness or something to do this. So I'm going to do this. And this is where, and in particular, I give a close reading of his 1953 Rome discourse, where I think he again launches his attempt to recuperate a structuralist reading of Freud, to promote a structuralist reading of Freud. And he's Lacan is also invested in his own disciplinary troubles and dramas.
And you just said this thing, Camille, about how the early familialists, of course, don't read Lévi-Strauss and Lacan because those texts aren't written yet. But even subsequent familialists, you one of the most sort of fascinating contributions I think that your book makes to the story of familialist discourse in France is the illumination of these players that you refer to as kind of bridge figures who brought the ideas of anthropology and psychoanalysis, brought the ideas of Lévi-Strauss and Lacan into the more public and political realm and imagination, sort of out of discourse and into practice, as it were. So I wonder if you could tell us a little bit about who these bridge figures were and what their roles were in the story that you're telling in the book.
So when I was trying to kind of reconstruct the story, I mean, the basic, you know, motivating question behind the book was how did these really complicated and really difficult theories of Lévi-Strauss and Lacan kinship make it to the political world? How did we have deputies quoting them during these debates around the family in the 1990s and 2000s? And when I thought originally that I would, you know, get the answer by reading enough Lévi-Strauss and reading enough Lacan, but I did, you know, in the beginning of the second chapter, and then I realized, you know, actually, that's just not going to get me anywhere because it's what they're getting is, I mean, they are using the language of Lévi-Strauss and Lacan. So understanding the language is one key to the puzzle, but it couldn't explain to me how these ideas were actually filtered through in the political and world and in the popular culture. So that concepts such as the symbolic that I mentioned, that play an important role in my argument in the second chapter, become kind of self-evident concepts in contemporary discourse in France. So the way that I, and this was where the archival research that I did was really sort of surprising and helpful to me, because I came across these figures that, as you said, are I called bridge figures in the books, and these were psychoanalysts or anthropologists who, in fact, had read Lévi-Strauss and Lacan, who had sometimes were close disciples or colleagues, and who were using these very abstract notions of kinship, and bringing them into translating them, I say, basically for politicians, for policy, and for law. And so I mentioned three people in particular in the book: Georges Moucaud, Françoise Dolto, and André Berge, who all played important role in public policy in France, basically from the 1930s until the 1960s. And I examine how they brought some of these ideas. These were three psychoanalysts, but more explicitly the ideas of Lacan, the kind of language that Lacan used, the symbolic, the phallus, the name of the father, kind of foundational concepts of Lacanian psychoanalysis, how they translated that for public policy.
So, Camille, the second part of the book focuses on family law and policies in the period from about the mid-1960s on, and after this exploration of the roots of familialism, you look at a range of critiques and sort of alternatives to a more traditional understanding of the family as the kind of foundation of the nation and the republic. And you refer to a quiet revolution in French family law and policy in this period. So I'm just wondering, what do you mean by this and what changes in the 1960s in France?
Yeah, so basically the book is, as you said, is set up in three parts. So the beginning examines what I call the rise of familialism. So I should say that the book is also interweaves chapters of intellectual history and political/legal history. So the rise of familialism, which is the first part of the book, covers what we just talked about, basically the emergence of familialism as a political discourse in law and in public policy, and then the rise of familialism in structuralism through the close readings of Lévi-Strauss and Lacan. And then finally, there's a chapter on these bridge figures that I was just talking about and how they managed to bring this complicated language to the political world and these complicated these complicated notions of familialism, how in some ways they provided the link between political familialism and structural familialism. Mm-hmm. So the second part of the book examines the critique of this model of familialism in the 1960s and 1970s. And there's, again, two axes to this. The first one is in public policy and in political culture, and the second one is in intellectual history. So I think you're asking me right now about the fourth chapter, which is basically what I called the quiet revolution. I didn't call it. A legal scholar called it the quiet revolution in family law. And this was... essentially, there's a couple of things that happen after the Second World War. So the de Gaulle is a huge familialist and basically really pushes family policy. And what's very interesting is that you'd think that after Vichy, the family would be a sort of tainted institution. Mm-hmm. And again, lots of historians have shown how the family was a crucial element of Vichy's of the National Revolution, basically. And so you think, it was difficult in some ways for de Gaulle to reclaim familialism and to make it seem like a republican institution that you'd want to promote and not disqualify. But he manages to do this, and I kind of examined that in detail in the book. And familialism, so not only that, but basically de Gaulle and his collaborators make the family benefits the key to the system of social security, which they institute right in the aftermath of World War II. So familialism continues to live basically until all through the Reconstruction, so the late 40s, 1950s. And then essentially there's a couple of things that happen. The first thing is that there's a new demographic panorama, in the sense that there's a sort of baby boom, and there's no longer a need to have as many children as there was before. In some ways, the family policy and the immigration policy worked. So there's less, there's less of an emphasis or less of an urgency for promoting family. There's also a change in political parties. Some of the parties that had been pushing for this familialist policies, in particular the MRP, lose some of their political importance basically during those years. And then the final thing that happens is that there's a, in terms of the civil code, there's this attempt, there's this kind of idea that some of the measures of the civil code are just, old or dépassé, that women can't be needing the signature of their husbands to make a check, or natural children, so with the legal term of natural children, which basically is the legal term for bastard children, don't have any recognitions. Also, for this was causing just a series of really complicated legal dilemmas, including, for example, famous cases like Picasso's children, who didn't get the inheritance because they're not legitimate. So there was just a kind of discrepancy between the code and the social mores. And so there's an attempt in the 60s and 70s to reform the civil code and to basically make it more adapted to social mores, more sociological and less abstract normative. And so again, what was interesting to me is that there's a kind of debate about the essence of the code, what the code should do in parliament and in legal journals. And there's very much two sides to this debate. So on one side, people who say, look, it doesn't matter what the empirical is or what the norm, what people do in their everyday life. The code needs to preserve law, because law needs to affirm kind of transcendental abstract values of how people should live, not how people live. Right. And on the other side, people saying like, no, this is absurd. The law needs to reflect, everyday realities. And this is a kind of tension that we're going to see throughout the 80s and 90s, but it starts during those years. And basically the people who are in favor of the law as a reflecting reality in some ways win, because natural children get, there's a reform affiliation in 1972, which basically allows natural children to receive inheritance. There's the reform of divorce, which makes divorce much easier. There's a series of reforms around that I mentioned that basically seem to make the family less abstract, less normative, and more like any other social institution, not the institution that determines everything else and that needs to be preserved for everything else to make sense.
Mm-hmm. You know, in recent years, well, as you know, Camille, there's been so much focus on the 60s and especially on the pivotal role that 68 plays, not just in France, but more globally. And I'm just wondering about that. You know, what's the significance of 68, this moment that we think of as a kind of explosive moment of political, cultural, sexual revolution and some of the changes that come out of that period and its aftermath? How does that fit into this history of familialism and some of the changes that you're talking about in this period?
Yeah, I mean, it very much fits in it, I think, because, you know, the 68, for the legal, you know, the in terms of what I just talked about, you know, 68 sort of crystallizes some of these social changes that were happening, you know, and it just is another manifestation of the fact that there's a real disconnect between law and how people are living their lives. Young people, especially, are living their lives. But the second importance of May 68 in the book is that, so I just mentioned the kind of political history critique of familialism, but there's also an intellectual critique of familialism, and this is the fifth chapter of the book. And in particular, you know, I'm interested in the way that what's referred to as the pensée 68, the kind of, you know, authors that what we call here kind of French theory, kind of the foundational figures of French theory. So Michel Foucault, Althusser, Deleuze and Guattari, who play a very, Deleuze and Guattari, the chapter is focused on Deleuze and Guattari and Ira Gray. So those are the kind of main figures of the chapter. Mm-hmm. How the critique of the heterosexual family and of familialism more specifically, is the conduit for their critique of society more generally. So in some ways, they take this idea of the structuralist social contract that people like Lacan and Levi-Strauss had posited and agree with it. They say, yes, there is an intimate link between familial structure, family structure, and social structure. But of course, what we want is a revolution. So we want a new social structure. So we need a new familial structure that will basically bring about this new society. And so the critique of society in their minds has to go through a critique of the family, and in particular through a critique of the Oedipus complex, which is the key to Lacan's structuralist, what I'm arguing is Lacan's structuralist social contract. So the chapter, looks at Deleuze and Guattari's Anti-Oedipus, which was published in 1972, and which was very much a reaction to May 68. You know, both authors are basically, Deleuze and Guattari, they say this in their diaries and in their papers. You know, they say, look, after May 68, we were both confronted with a problem. How is it that workers are not revolting when they should be revolting? You know, it's like, and this is the kind of story of the failed worker revolt in May 68, so that, you know, the students were ready to go all the way, and then the workers settled for better wages, better work conditions, better, you know, just basically settled instead of taking revolution all the way. And so, you know, their conclusion is basically, well, you know, we have to think about what is in people's minds, basically, that is blocking the real revolution. What is it that is and the answer they give is basically Oedipus. Oedipus is what is inside people's minds that is preventing them from being truly free, truly liberated. And so, of course, the way to have true liberation is to get rid of Oedipus, to de-Oedipalize.
Right. I'm wondering, Camille, how some of these changes that you're talking about in this period and in the 1960s and then into the 70s, how are they connected to, you know, the sort of broader French political and even economic landscape? You know, we think of this as a period of intense consumer culture and changes in terms of political parties and some of those kinds of things. Is there still this kind of common denominator of family is at the heart of everything? Or do some of these other dynamics affect the course of familialism in this period.
Yeah, no, I think you're right. I think the other dynamics do affect the course of familialism. And all of a sudden, it seems like the family has just lost the central political claim it had, you know. So it becomes, for example, you know, this is the beginning of, I mean, this goes back a little bit to the chapter chapter four, which is more about political history. But, it, you know, other issues come to the forefront. For example, single mothers, you know, the famille monoparentale is the sort of the beginning of single parent households. And they want specific rights, too. So is that, can you count these households as, you know, do these households get family benefits or do they not? And of course, when family benefits were conceived of at the end of the 19th century, you know, they were for large, numerous families, not for all families, right? So this is the question that begins to be very interesting in the 60s and 70s of who counts as a family? How do we rethink the limits of family? And I think, you know, what's interesting is that the new players on the scene, so in the 60s, it's mostly, as I said, single mothers, but later, you know, by the time it's the 80s, it becomes also, you know, divorced parents, but also, and then by the 90s, it's, you know, same-sex families, how they also play with this language of a family and who, you know, if the family is going to be the key to the social, we're a family too, and we want certain rights also. And so then it becomes an interesting debate about who, you know, about what, with the family, is the family precisely this kind of universal, abstract, normative entity, or is it reflective of social change?
We've talked, Camille, about, you know, the dynamics of the interactions between French intellectual and political life and policy and some of these other things. And I'm just, something you said just a moment ago made me think, okay, I understand the uniqueness of the French context here, but is there an outside that infiltrates in any way, just in terms of, I don't know, British or American ideas or policies or influences? Like, is it a closed system? Or is there any kind of transnational exchange of ideas about, you know, the theoretical ideas, but also potentially political and policy ideas?
Yeah, the question of the outside is very interesting because it changes throughout in the book, basically, you know, into the different periods. But the first thing to say is that the French system of family policy was France was one of the first countries to have an elaborate system of family policy. And if some historians of fascist Italy, such as Vittorio De Grazia, for example, has suggested that, you know, that Mussolini got inspired by France in terms of family policy. So it did look outside, you know. French family policymakers did constantly look outside. Of course, in the 30s, the outside that they were looking to was Germany and Italy, right? Saying these countries had a particularly, you know, they had been able to solve the kind of depopulation problem. They had been able to solve the numerical problem, you know, of a population, especially the Germans. And this, they had done this through a strong family policy. So that's how the reference to the outside functioned in those early years. And in the later years, I mean, yes, again, there is this idea that other countries are doing things differently. And in particular, there's a very interesting tension between kind of common law and civil law. And, you know, and so there is this idea that, look, especially the Anglo-Saxon system is basically has a system of law, family law, where, you know, things just adapt as things go. So you argue for a case and then becomes a precedent and then it goes on. You know, there's not this obsession with thinking about with abstraction, basically, and with normativity, with abstract normativity, I'd say. And so the last part of the book, which deals with contemporary laws, so like questions about bioethics, questions about same-sex parenting, questions about divorces. In those cases, the French are very much aware of what's happening outside, but they're also wary of it. You know, you don't want a system like the American system, where they're very worried about having a system where the law would lose all of its symbolic power, is the words they are using, you know, not like America doesn't have a symbolic power, but it's, or, you know?
Right.
So they're trying to preserve a kind of national understanding of the law. And certainly in terms of intellectual history too, you know, there is, I mean, I think you're right. Like there is also, you know, a critique of structuralism coming from the outside, that that starts to infiltrate French theory. So not so much with Deleuze and Guattari and Irigaray, but certainly the people who come after. There's a very strong critique of structural anthropology in the U.S. You know, there's a within anthropology, there's a and of course with feminism, there's a strong critique of both of the of a kind of limited vision of structuralist anthropology and structuralist psychoanalysis.
Sure. Just was starting to talk about the sort of last part of the book where you talk about this return of familialism, that if there are these critiques and challenges in the 1960s and 70s, that into the 1980s, you describe and analyze a return to the structuralist social contract and following this intense period. So what accounts for this return in French intellectual and political life in your estimation?
That's the key to the book, that I don't know if I exactly found it, but I do trace this return. There's a return in the 80s. The explanation I give is that it's after this critique, this intense political and intellectual critique of familialism in the right now we're in the early 80s. There's this attempt to say, okay, not everything should be subject to critique or to a debate about rights, that we need to go back to certain universal transcendental values, so the family becomes one of these values that you want to affirm. So as I said, a lot of this plays out in around the language of rights. So people who were asking for new rights, as I said, single parent household, same-sex parents, are saying we have the rights to be families. We have rights to, you know, conceive, to have access to reproductive technology. We have access. We have rights to marriage. We have the right to give life is a right that they ask for. And basically, there's a very interesting return or a response to this, because you know the people who are worried about this kind of this intense change say, look, it's not just, we can't just have a society where everyone argues for their own little private right. We need to think about the social. We need to think about the coherence of the social, the kind of the unity of the social, because all of these little rights are disintegrating or fragmenting the cohesion and the unity of the national body. And this is the kind of Republican thinker, the return of some Republican thinkers. And it's not just in terms of sexuality, you know, it happens all over the place. It's people who are, affiliated with journals such as Le Débat, journals such as Esprit, there's a great anxiety about the problem of difference and abstract universalism during those years, starting in the 1980s and up to the 1990s. So in the book, I trace how sexuality functions, but you could, you know, there's similar concerns around immigration, around, other questions, basically.
Well, and I wanted to ask you about that, Camille, how this other history that's going on in the 20th century, a history of race and empire and immigration and, you know, in the post-war context, a kind of post-colonial condition, I guess we could call it, in France. What's the relationship between those histories and the one that you're looking at in this book?
Yeah, I think, that's a hard one to figure out, but I think the two histories are completely co-extensive or they work together. Mm-hmm. You can't think one without the other. One of the interesting threads, for example, that I trace is that the institutions that create family policy at the early 20th century are the same institutions that develop the immigration code. So basically, someone like Georges Moucault, for example, one of the bridge figures I analyzed, starts out as an expert on immigration policy, and then moves to family policy. So there's a kind of very, very strong link at the level of policy between thinking immigration and thinking the family. And it's not just at the level of policy, it's also just, more generally, both entail a certain question about reproduction of the nation and who's going to reproduce and what is going to be reproduced. And so I think those two categories are constantly mixing and sort of interweaving throughout the 20th century. And I think, again, the critique of the family also happens in the 60s and 70s around the time of decolonization. And the language of decolonization is constantly permeating the language of family, a critique of familialism, like that, you know, the people talk about the kind of decolonization of the married wife, for example, you know. So there's lots of interesting, you know, I don't have a kind of overall theoretical answer, but there's lots of interesting links between the two. And certainly in the 80s, I think it's very clear that these debates around the family happen around the same time as debates around immigration, and that there's a general anxiety about who is French, who counts as French, who is going to be French. And one of the things that interested me in the book is that the PACS, so the civil union agreements, gave basically all the rights that marriage gives, except immigration and filiation. Mm. In other words, like, you didn't have any parenting rights when you don't have any parenting rights when you sign a PACS, and you don't have any nationality rights when you sign a PACS, unlike marriage. So I think, again, the fact that these two are the excluded, the excluded rights are interesting, because you also see how they go hand in hand, how in some ways, there was a reticence to pass gay marriage, which would give, this was, you know, obviously before the law was passed, but there was a kind of worry that if we allowed, gays to reproduce, what would be reproduced, right? What would be, and similar conditions, you know, similar anxieties about immigration. Again, like, if we, do we give, you know, do we continue having the right of soil? Do we revoke that? So, you know.
Right. Well, and I, you know, it's come up a number of times, and you've even talked about this as sort of one of your motivations for writing the book, these contemporary debates in France about homosexuality and adoption and the family. And, you know, I found the book really illuminating in terms of understanding. You know, people would ask me in the last few years, like, what's going on if it's over adoption, like, with some level of shock, right? That
right.
Something that they might associate with, I don't know, a more conservative American approach to the family or ideas about those things, that was sort of surprising in to some of my North American friends and colleagues, like, why are the French so upset about this? Yeah. And some surprising voices speaking out in very strong terms about, you know, homosexual couples adopting or So, you know, what can you say, Camille, in sort of broad terms about how you think the book, or how you see the book, as making a contribution to our understanding of these contemporary debates and struggles in France today?
Yeah, so I think, you know, one of the questions that people were asking me when I was writing this book, or when I was talking about it, was, you know, well, at the end of the day, you know, these people who are opposed to adoption by same-sex couples or just single parents, you know, they're using this complicated vocabulary of, like, Con Levi-Strauss, but at the end of the day, aren't they just homophobes, or aren't they just bigots, or, you know, and it's always this question of, like, of course they are. But what's interesting, the kind of, for me, the interesting historical question is to think about, you know, why they would turn to a certain rhetoric in a particular time. So why certain arguments make sense in certain contexts and not in other contexts, and in particular times. So why they were using these very complicated notions in France, and certainly, you know, and you don't see, you know, Mitt Romney appealing to, you know, when he's trying to oppose DOMA. So what makes sense in one country doesn't make sense in another country. So I think this tells us a lot about French political culture. And I think one of the things that it tells us about French political culture is that there's a big concern about reproduction. In terms of the gay marriage debates, it's interesting to think about the differences and the similarities between the U.S. and France. And, you know, there's many, and there'd be more to say about this. But one of the things that's interesting is that, you know, the American debate has focused mostly on the question of marriage. You know, like the DOMA, but also the that's been the fight. And in France, the real stumbling block has been affiliation or reproduction. You know, mm-hmm. the idea that it's interesting to think about, again, the differences between the two countries, and to think about why marriage remains such an important institution in the U.S. in the way that it isn't in France anymore. So of course there was a big push to marriage now in France, for same-sex marriage, but it was basically because marriage was the only law that would allow same-sex couples to adopt children together. So not just the single individuals, but together. So there's many interesting similarities and differences, but I think this is a specifically French story because it didn't play out in the same way in any other country where there has been debates. You know, I think all countries have had debates about gay marriage, or reproductive technologies, but the way that the kind of arguments that I trace in the book, I think, tell us a lot about French history and French culture.
Mm-hmm. Well, I can't resist. I have to ask you about the sort of most recent scandal about François Hollande and, you know, the family at stake in all of that. And, you know, whether you have comments on that whole craziness with respect to some of the things you explore in the book.
I haven't followed it as closely as I should probably, but partly it's out of ennui but I think the one interesting analysis I read, which I've been thinking about, has been Eric Fassin's, who always writes really interesting pieces about these questions, about everything, but about this question in particular. And his argument was that basically Hollande was shifting from the kind of modern kinship, you know, where he was unmarried to Ségolène Royal with four children, etc., to a kind of, and unmarried to Valérie, you know, to a kind of model of aristocracy, basically the monarchic model, where you again go after a younger woman, you know. So there was this kind of idea of that would reinstate a kind of virility, right? A kind of recognizable virility, like enough with modernity. Now let's get back to being a real man, right? To go back to that old trope of seducing a much younger woman. So I don't know, you know, I don't have very much more to say about that, but I thought that was sort of interesting. And certainly, you know, I certainly think, just like the DSK affair, just like also the American sex scandals, that these tell us a lot again about the importance of sexuality and for thinking politics, and the kind of the way that sexuality really brings to light certain very important political questions.
Well, and there does seem to be this sort of tolerance, and I mean, at least when viewed from the North American perspective, I think this sort of tolerance in France for a kind of presidential all over the placeness in terms of family and sexuality and scandal that people have talked about for years. Well, Camille, I've taken up a lot of your time, so I'd like to ask you one final question, which is, what are you working on now?
So I have basically like a ton of projects that have started, but the one I have more that my archival research is more or less completed for, that I want to start writing soon, is a project on a movement that is called institutional psychotherapy. And it's basically a movement of critique of psychiatry that started after World War II. And I got interested in this because of the chapter on Deleuze and Guattari. Guattari worked in a clinic, in a psychiatric clinic called La Borde, where they experimented with all kinds of psychiatric treatments. And one of the ideas was that you're not sick because of your brain, but because of the social environment that you're in. So you need to reform the social before you begin. You can think about reforming, you know, your unconscious, and so or treating your unconscious. And so at La Borde, and this clinic of La Borde was, you know, the main person there was Jean Houry, but one of the theorists behind this movement was this Catalan doctor called François Tosquelles, who went from Spain to France during the 30s, and he's one of the people who basically brought psychoanalysis to the French psychiatric world. He was an avid reader of Lacan, very interested in the question of language and psychosis, and he created this hospital called Saint-Alban in the Lozère, in a really remote place in France, where he was interested in thinking about madness and the social together. And it was interesting because a lot of famous and people went through that hospital. So Georges Canguilhem was there, France Fanon did his residency there, and so he used some of the techniques he learned there in Algeria, Jean Houry, and then Guattari. So, and then, you know, surrealist like Tristan Tzara was there for a while, and Paul Éluard. So there's a kind of it's a kind of interesting microcosm to think about what I call psychic occupation and disoccupation, right? How you can disoccupy your psyche.
It sounds like a fascinating project.
Yeah, I hope I can get to it. But right now I've been so, I mean, before I get to that, I have to finish the one last thing, which is that I'm writing right now about the Vatican's obsession with gender. So once that is done, which is also sort of linked to the book, but the Vatican has been really obsessed with thinking about gender and writing about gender. So that's the, those are the kind of two main projects that I'm working on right now.
Well, I'll hopefully get a chance to talk to you about one or both of those projects if they emerge in new book form at some point in the future. I just want to say thanks so much, Camille, for joining me and for writing this fascinating book. Yeah,
thank you so much, Roxane, for talking to me. This was great.
You've been listening to New Books in French Studies. Thanks so much for tuning in, and I hope you'll join us again next time.